session number 30108, Real 8.
So there's Real 8. So John, what was the next one? How long were you in the Falklands, and when did you return to the United Kingdom?
Oh, I came back with the all the Marines, basically, most of the 3rd Commando Brigade were put on the Canberra. And I came back with that group. The aircraft were put on a ship taken up from trade, and we didn't see them, basically. And that was a well-thought-out plan, I think. We put one Remy guy, as far as I recall. Maybe they came back on the Norland, rings a bell. And a maintainer went on there, and we were put on the Canberra. Forget about flying our lads, relax, going home. And all the bootnecks went on there. Well, wise decision again, all the pilots went however they travelled. And probably that was a sensible thing to do as well.
And you'd said that before you went to the Falklands, you were getting ready to be drafted away from the squadron. Was that the case when you got back to the UK, that you were about to be drafted?
Well, I stayed in the squadron, actually, for another 9 months, because there was a move from Coypool to Yeovilton, and the scouts were being phased out, so a lot of us in B Flight were involved in planning that move up to Yeovilton, sorting out how many married quarters would be needed, etc, etc. And then around about Christmas time, the administration officer said, any chance of you going to Norway in such and such a role, because a guy was leaving, and I said, okay, I'd do that. And then in about March 83, I then went to 4-2 Commando. Within that time, I'd gone for officer selection, and because I'd been aircrew for 5 years, the Major General at that time deemed it wiser for me to go back to a commando unit, do a ground tour, get some more experience. And so I went to 4-2 Commando.
And is that when you did a tour of Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I went to Northern Ireland in the second year of that tour. We did a Canada trip in the first year. That was the main trip for 4-2. And Exercise Pond Jump West. Came back from that and started gearing up for Northern Ireland, he said. No, I tell a lie, we did Norway and then we went to Northern Ireland. Whatever, busy programme, as it is always in a commando unit.
You described quite well what was going on in the 70s in Northern Ireland. How had things changed by the 80s?
Well, then it became more the multiple commanders war. And so a troop was split in half. Troop sergeant was a multiple patrol commander of one half. Troop officer had the other half. We were all dispatched to the training NATAT people to do a patrol commander's course, and then back to the unit and started gearing up our guys for Ireland. Also different in that patrols, particularly on the border, were 13, so you'd operate in 3 teams. Generally, 1 static, 2 moving. You'd take policemen out with you. If you were doing vehicle checkpoints, you would bounce along roads, so you'd go off into the countryside, appear at a road with your with 1 team of 4 and a couple of policemen, and the other 2 teams would conduct satellite patrols, so that if you were unfortunate enough to be sitting on an explosive device, someone couldn't come in to initiate it, because the satellite patrols would deter them. Or if a sniper tried to come in and have a go at your checkpoint, your satellite patrols would do that. But generally, in that, I was in M Company, and it was boosted up to 5, and it was designated patrol company, boosted up to 5 troops. And we were sort of rent-a-company, so if another company was doing an operation in its area, we would go out and place cordons in. But it was almost like conventional warfare. You'd have to dig a slit trench. So you'd be in the Irish countryside digging a slit trench, because they had mortars, they had heavy machine guns, and laying on the ground just didn't cut the mustard with the type of firepower they had. Equally, we had moved on from just carrying SLRs, and we had many more automatic weapons available within the multiple. M79 grenade launcher, a lot of electronic equipment.
What did that involve? Was that electronic? Was that to detect potential explosives, that sort of thing?
To detect and to block. And some of that equipment may still be classified, because I saw some yesterday, and it's probably best to say that electronic equipment.
It seems, though, that the patrols are really beefed up for the stuff on the border, as opposed to the sort of urban thing that you're doing in the 70s, because you've got an awful lot more firepower, haven't you? But was that a change in what the IRA had by that stage?
Well, they had a lot more expertise, probably. They'd been at it a long time anyway. And that firepower we needed probably to extricate ourselves from potentially catastrophic situations. If you think of the two aircraft that the Paras lost when they flew into, I think it was Carlingford Lock or somewhere like that. I mean, the IRA didn't do ad hoc operations. They were well planned, thought out in detail. And, you know, we had to have the capacity to respond to that, either to counteract it or to get out of a tricky situation. I mean, we were flown everywhere, in and out, so we were dropped off, picked up. There was no road movement.
None at all? None whatsoever.
No road movement. We didn't even walk along roads. We, as I said, we bounced onto roads to a VCP. If you're on foot patrol, we didn't conduct mobile patrols at all. No wheeled movement.
What was the dangers that you would perceive in the border area as well? I mean, you mentioned some of the weaponry they would have, but what were you most likely to encounter?
Culvert bombs, probably. Yeah, command wire.
You say heavy, would heavy...
And a come-on. So, a minor incident, and, say, us being drawn into a situation, and to set up our... incident control point, but that's where the device would be. So, you know, it wouldn't take the brains of an archbishop, a Roman Catholic archbishop, to sit there and say, okay, if there's an incident in such and such a place, where would they likely place a control point, an incident control point? And that's really our biggest fear, I suppose, being blown up. Friends of mine were blown up, never found again, obliterated, disappeared, because they manned an OP which had been manned in the past. And in between times, a milchion of explosive had been buried under this particular site. Two guys went in, and it was detonated. And, I mean, they're just vaporised, nothing at all, nothing to bury.
Was this stuff from the IRA's observation of military procedure? Almost?
Possibly. Possibly. I mean, I suppose some of it could have been done on a map appreciation. But if an incident happened twice in one place, then on our side, we'd most definitely be thinking, where did we go last time? Because we ain't going to go there this time. It's all double bluff, I suppose.
And did they have the ability to get back over the border very, very quickly from an incident like that?
Well, I think most of them probably lived over the border. I think they only came across for an operation and then went back. I doubt if they lived in the north.
Would some of the operations, actually, you know, you say a culvert bomb, would that sometimes be detonated from the other side of the border? Could that be?
Possibly, yeah. Either radio control or command wire. Our perception was that they preferred a command wire than radio control, because they could be setting that up and someone down the road flashes his mobile phone on or something, then an exterior force could... cause an own goal, as it were. Whereas at least with a command wire, they can put the explosive in, dig in the command wire. All they have to do at any moment in time is turn up with a battery at the initiating end. You know, there's not less danger to them.
What was the kind of terrain like down by the border?
Thick hedges, stone walls, sometimes double stone walls. Filled at top of which there'd be blackthorn hedges, almost impenetrable, barbed wire everywhere. Not allowed to cut it because, it's damage to civilian property for a start. Not good for hearts and minds, but very quickly there'd be a complaint come in. And often complaints would come in totally spurious. You know?
Things that you were supposed to have done.
Supposed to have done and didn't. I'm sure some things were done. But, yeah, it was a game of cat and mouse, I suppose.
Would you be aware of that hearts and mind element all the time?
Yeah, oh yeah, that we were clearly briefed before we went over. And look, you're not going there to cause trouble, upset the local populations. You're there to, and because it was police primacy then, I think was the word, and we were there to support the law and order infrastructure of Northern Ireland. We weren't there as an occupying power. We were there to provide support so the Royal Ulster Constabulary, as it was, could go out and do their business.
And the local populace down in the border?
Ambivalent towards us. And whether that was because of their political leanings or whether it was a self-preservation, I don't know. Some people on the border clearly made a very lucrative living with cross-border trading, shall we say. And it was not in their interest to have a police presence interfering with some money-making scheme that they had going at the time.
Was there any way that the border was marked, or was it just there was a number of crossing points, or...?
Well, our patrol maps were marked, but they weren't physically marked on the ground once you were out in the fields. You had to be fairly careful that you didn't stray over. Again, if there were infringements, they would have been accidental. And I'm sure that they happen. Sometimes they may have been noticed by a local and reported, but... you know, I can't believe someone, if you're going on patrol, you've got so much to think about. Why a border infringement just for the sake of it? Life's complicated enough.
Would you have any contact with the Southern Irish?
No.
Military authorities?
No. Not me personally, whether there was at a sort of police level, in a perhaps a hot pursuit situation. I'm sure the special branch on one side had contacts with special branch on the other side, and I'm sure that military intelligence would have been the same, but the man on the ground is really just living day to day, surviving, making sure that he's got the equipment with him, and he's got his own little world that's far above him.
How are things otherwise significantly changed in the 80s? You said things were a little bit more professional by the 80s, of how you were...
Oh, yeah. I mean, in going out on a patrol, everyone knew why we were going out. There was a purpose to it. What we were going to do, who was going to do what job. Like, one guy was definitely M79, and I would tell a guy with an M79, sling your weapon, because I need you to be able to fire that grenade quickly, rather than... Loads of us have got rifles, but we need the M79 ready at all times.
What would that have been useful for?
Get an immediate bang down at the other end. Whether that was for us to withdraw, take stock, just time, give you a little bit of time. And it's a pretty effective way of getting the other side to take the head down, because they've already got the initiative. It's a question of regaining the initiative.
So does that give you a psychological advantage as well, that bang on the enemy?
Well, winning the firefight is all, isn't it? Because if they've started the firefight, you can't do anything until their heads are down. Because until their heads are down, while their heads are up, yours have got to be down.
Were there any incidents that spring to mind over this period while you were on the border?
No. I remember a guy actually trod on a bomb. And a lot of it was homemade explosive. So the homemade explosive element didn't go off. But the initiating element, the commercial explosive, went off. And it blew him off his feet. They were actually channeled. And because of these thick hedges, he had to go through this gap. And as he went through the gap, someone somewhere initiated it, the device, it blew him off his feet. But very, very lucky man. Very lucky man. And a lot of petrol tankers, so they were all come on. Petrol tankers used to be placed at border crossing points. So they would be hijacked, probably booby-trapped, and you could see all the stuff underneath them. And again, that was just tedious because your cordon would have to go in for days, and then the bomb disposal guys would be involved, and hard on them, psychologically, I guess.
Was there an element there to do that, to tie up as much time and resources from yourselves occasionally?
Well, I suppose if you've got someone tied up somewhere in a place, what's happening somewhere else? Yeah. I'm sure there was a strategy. They had a strategy. It wasn't just a bunch of paddies running around thinking, you know, let's knock off a few Brits. We've got to give them more credit than that.
What happened at the end of that tour?
I was commissioned. We came back and I went down and went on a 3-day board, basically. I think there were 20 blokes on the board. 12 were successful, and then we went on a, straight after Christmas, we went on a selection course of about 6 weeks. This system has changed now. This isn't as it is today. We had a 6-week selection course, and there were 9 of us successful on that. 2 guys who had been RSMs then joined us, so 11 of us then were on a 2 to 3 month post-commissioning course, at the end of which we were sent off to be officers fulfilling various roles within the Corps, either within 3 Commando Brigade or within the other part of the Corps. Because we've got 2 parts of the Corps, really. We've got the fighting part and the training and administration and all those other things that need to be done.
Where did you go to?
I went to be an impressed holder, which is an old naval term for paymaster in the Army, of the Commando Logistic Regiment. I wish it, 2-year appointments generally.
So at this stage, you have less of the open ended sort of or tour of things, but you have an appointment period.
You have an appointment, yeah. And they're mostly 2 years. And of course, your whole condition of service has changed. So instead of doing 22 years, you're then eligible to serve until you're 50. And some guys go beyond that, of course. So, you know, you look on life then in 2-year stretches, if you like, and you try to pick jobs which you think would be interesting. And
how much element of choice do you get in that?
Not bad. I mean, although my first 2 jobs were both in the southwest of England, and then the appointer did say, "Well, look, John, you've done 2 in the southwest. A lot of people want to be in the southwest. Off to Merseyside you go," and off I went up to Merseyside, which was a reserve unit with satellite in Manchester and Birmingham, and from there I went to Staff College when it was at Greenwich, Naval Staff College, for 9 months.
How did you enjoy that?
Oh, that was good. No phone. Big in tray, burning the midnight oil, but in most of these officer appointments you're working for the good of a group of people. You're working for them. When you're at Staff College, you're working for you. So it's 9 months in which to be selfish. And you can put as much or as little, no, you can't put as little effort in as you want, but you can gauge the level of effort you put in, but the more you put in, the better it will be for you ultimately, I suppose.
And what was the kind of course like? What was the areas that you covered?
International politics, international affairs, British defence, policy, British industrial policy. International law, particularly law of the sea, United Nations conventions for laws of the sea, you name it, all lecture room stuff, but a lot of cross training with the Army Staff College and the RAF Staff College, which were all separate then. Trip to Germany, so we could see a battle group, and we all sat in slit trenches and got attacked by this battle group coming towards us, the rumbling of tanks and scary stuff that the armies have, which we're not used to, or were never used to in those days in the Corps. But it was interesting, and it sort of allows you to take the old blinkers off a little bit, and because you learn obviously more about the other services.
I assume as well that you learn a little bit about what you've done in your own career to that point, because you understand things that you may not have understood early down.
Yeah, you suddenly realise that you were part of a much greater scheme of things, and as important as each infanteer is with his rucksack and his rifle, I call it rucksack, I should revert to the terminology of Bergen, it is part of a greater plan. But the beauty of it is, the guy, the infanteer, he doesn't care about that greater plan anyway. He only cares about his chum. Does he need to know? He needs to know a certain amount. But he'll still give it the finger, and he fights for his mate.
But you would have understood that, obviously, coming up through where you did, I suppose, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, if you ask a guy what he fights for, he isn't going to say queen or country. He's going to say my section, my troop. Getting out of your bag in the morning is so you don't lose face.
So you did Staff College. What was your next appointment?
I went back to my second stint in Commando Log Regiment as a quartermaster. For 2 years, and that, you know, was a normal round of exercises in Norway, still Norway. And then I did 2 years after that as the Royal Marines Public Relations Officer in the MOD, which is all the terminology. It was, I was really staff officer to the Department of Public Relations, back as Navy, now called something else. Got to keep changing the names of things, haven't we? Otherwise, you civilians be able to understand what's going on. You do anyway, because it's your job too. But, yeah, that was very interesting. Very interesting, MOD. And then you realise that the military don't run the military anyway. The civil service runs the military. You know?
At that stage, were you going each day, would you be in civilian clothing for that?
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, when I worked with the reservists in Merseyside, because of the security threat which still existed, and while I worked up there, Deal was bombed, of course, so we were always very aware of the security threat on the mainland. A guy was killed down in Lichfield Station around about that time, so things were still happening on the Irish-British front. So I wore civvies there as well. I was very lucky for 10 years in some ways that I was able to live in a flat in civvies, but unlucky in that it doesn't do much for family life, because you're going to work on a Monday, coming home on a Friday, and the coming home is like 310 miles door to door. So world apart from the first part of the career.
So after that period, what was your next appointment?
Well, my final appointment, when I was up in, I went back to Log Regiments as OC Headquarters Squadron. So that actually meant I'd been the impress holder of the quartermaster and commanded a squadron in Log Regiment, which was quite good, quite fulfilling. And I had one more job to do after that, so I went as the area officer of the Sea Cadets Northwest in the Royal Naval Headquarters in Liverpool. My patch was Stafford to Carlisle, across into Anglesey, basically from the Pennines to Anglesey, and the Isle of Man. So 60 units, which had to be inspected once a year to ensure that they were up to standards laid down by the Royal Navy. And so I did 3 years up there. And then that 3 years was an extra year of service, so I retired the day before my 51st birthday, by which time I was living in New Zealand, and that's where we shall stay.
Just one really last question. How do you feel now about having served with the Royal Marines?
Marvellous. My son